I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. It's Monday, February 6th. And colleagues, we're having a number of amendments. I don't see how LC is going to be keeping up with everybody's request for amendments. And then, depending on the amendment, we have to make a request for a fiscal, and we don't know which amendment's going to go through. So it's really a hectic process. I think having a crammed policy work is making it really difficult. We're trying to treat this as a regular session, and the timeline is just too short. With that, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1503. Sandy, just remind us what that bill is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1503, you'll recall, is the flu vaccination that requires healthcare workers to provide the healthcare employer evidence that the worker has received an annual seasonal influenza vaccination or submit a written declaration of the workers declining the vaccination.
And Senator Bates, I think that you have the dash threes.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you explain what the dash threes? It doesn't mean we're going to pass it, but I figure let's discuss the amendments and then decide. And then I need to get a feeling for whether we want the original bill or what. Okay? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, we're in support of the basic bill if it works. And we're concerned that it doesn't go far enough, especially in situations where you have healthcare workers. I don't mean just nurses and doctors, but anybody involved with patient care who could be exposing patients, especially in hospital settings, that have illnesses. You might be immune suppressed.
Okay, just one minute. Is this Gary Weeks?
Yes, it is.
Okay, you're down the line a bit.
On the line and down the line, yeah.
And so you can either hold Gary or we're going through some other bills first. It will be probably...
All right, I'll just hold on so I don't interrupt again.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Sorry, can I continue?
Yeah.
We're in a position here that workers, especially in the hospital setting, but other settings too, you know, the first 8 to 10 days that you are carrying a virus like influenza around, you don't even have any symptoms, but you're still passing the virus. And you could be dealing with patients who are immune suppressed because of cancer drugs or because of cancers. You could be dealing with people who are recovering from serious operations or injuries, and you're passing that virus to them, and there's really no way of knowing you're doing it. Admittedly, you know, influenza vaccines are not 100%. It's an estimated guess whether the right one to use, but they're pretty effective in most cases and help have this what we call herd immunity and try to avoid people being touched by these viruses that become life-threatening to those people. So the registry is a good step in the right direction, but what the dash 3 says, that under present law, getting an influenza vaccination is not a condition of work. What this would allow institutions to do on an institution-by-institution basis, if by 2014 we haven't reached the 80% threshold, basically looking at some herd immunity for the most part, that each institution can make its own mind up if they wanted to make that mandatory to work here. You got to have a vaccination in order to work here. It's not requiring all of them to do it. It just says at that point, if you haven't reached 80% and you want to make that part of a condition of work, you have the right to go ahead and do so, and you can do it by institution. We think that's a reasonable way of looking at this. It gives people an opportunity to get ready for it, but by 2014, we need to be moving forward. You know, we just went about a year and a half, 2 years ago, we took a near miss on H1N1, and had been for an incredible effort, which we've all kind of forgotten by public health. That could have been an absolute disaster in this country. We were lucky enough to produce enough vaccine quickly enough and get it out there to people that we actually headed off what could have been a really bad epidemic. That does not say that will not happen again, and we want to be ready for that kind of situation. So this is a step in the right direction. We just think 03-3 amendments really set this up to be something that will really actually work in the long run. And I also make a comment that when we talked about this among some of our colleagues, they were kind of hard, I gotta put this, they felt hard to believe why this was such a big issue. Why, when they go to the hospital, they have to be at risk for a hospital employee bringing them an illness when they're there trying to get well. So I'll stop there, and I'd ask the committee to consider the dash threes.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a fundamental problem with the sunset idea, but I do have some problems with the next step, which is that essentially mandating that we shift gears into a condition of employment next. I do believe that the end result, what we're trying to accomplish here, is to get more people vaccinated in these settings. And I believe that the purpose of this bill is to use the carrot to move forward. And I have some concerns that the proponents of the bill, I don't think, have been fully consulted with this amendment today. And that what it's saying is, we'll use the carrot for a little while, but then we're going to whack you with the big stick shortly thereafter. And I appreciate Dr. Bates trying to get more people to yes, and I think it's coming from a very good place, but I would have a difficult time supporting this amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Questioned Senator Bates. Is there any room in here for example, religious exemptions, or is it all in?
We would expect that if people came to you with religious or physical exemptions, if they've had Guillain-Barré disease in the past and right. want to be exempted from this, if they have MS, they want to be exempted from this, there would be obvious reasons that there would be exemptions, and of course on a religious basis. You know, it is basically a mandatory condition of going to public school that you get certain vaccinations. This falls into that kind of thinking, but there has to be, of course, exemptions to it. There can't be a blanket thing that's required. But we want to make it, you know, something that we can really start getting some progress on. I'm just afraid that the process we're going to go through here won't be successful.
I guess, Madam Chair, my concern is because it doesn't address that. Maybe language needs to be in there that would direct the health authority to. They probably would.
By rule. I know you love that.
they probably would, but they might not necessarily, and I'm just wondering if we need to be a little more. I know.
Well, I'd be very open to making that change to the dash threes, okay, that there would be exceptions by rule.
Okay. We have the Hospital Association and the Nurses Association in front of us right now. The Hospital Association, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The Dash 3 amendments are ones that we worked out with Dr. Bates and Dr. Steiner Hayward, or senators, sorry. And I wanted to clarify one thing, Senator Shields. I want to clarify that what's in that amendment is that if the stats that are already in the original bill, if the statistics don't bear out that 80% have voluntarily complied, then it doesn't make it mandatory. It takes out the prohibition that would negate you making it mandatory. So then it just leaves it up. It doesn't make it mandatory. It's not prohibited. You as an employer can decide whether you want to make it mandatory in your clinic, your hospital, your nursing home, or you don't, or something in between, or you like the way that the voluntary compliance is going. So I wanted to clear that up because I thought I heard you say something that it would mandate it, and it actually would not mandate it.
Well, I think we're talking semantics here. I think most hospitals would use it, right? Isn't that your point?
Well, that would be up to each hospital, and if they were represented by unions, it would be up to the bargaining table because it's to make something a condition of employment. And if they were not union, then it would be up to management to make that decision, as with every clinic and every nursing home and every other healthcare setting, doctor's offices. It would be up to the individual. Our belief is some would, some wouldn't. A report came out today from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and they did a little tally of every state, and 20 states already have mandatory requirements. So,
as a condition of employment?
Correct.
Yeah, they have, what?
Do most of those have the exemptions that
Senator Cruz, most do, and a couple didn't have an X in that box, which I found odd, but of course you always have to allow the exemptions. And the way that the amendment reads is that the department will adopt rules allowing employers to decide, and those rules, of course, would include any exemptions, and those would be there as they should be.
Nurses Association.
Jack Dempsey, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I would say we oppose the Dash 3 amendments, as you might guess. We brought this forward to try something, to take a first step. I don't think we need to take the next three steps. I think there are a number of other groups that have worked with on this that also want to try something that hasn't been done before. The Healthcare Association, AARP, SEIU, AFSCME, State Ambulance Association, Coho Family Care, the Ben Bolton wrote an editorial on it. I think people want to try something, and I think we need to give this a shot. I don't think it makes sense to project out 3 years from now what may or may not happen. We don't know what the world's going to look like then. If we need to address this at that time, let's do it. And you'll have all the data in the world to come back at me and say, hey, this only got to 60%. We need to do something different. But to project that out now, I don't think is good policy sense.
Senator Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been thinking a lot about this one, and as usual, came up with one of my ideas as I'm walking down the stairs to the meeting, so I apologize for the surprise part of this. I guess I'm a little curious about why we're only dealing with nurses. Because really, we've got housekeeping staff, we've got dietitians, we've got physical therapists, we've got doctors.
It's healthcare employees.
I think it should, I mean, personally, I'd like to know about the entire staff of the hospital, anybody who has privileges, anybody who's employed by the hospital, because anybody could transmit influenza to this. Well, and I'm not trying workers. To muddy the waters further, but I guess as a physician, I'd like to know that my patients are protected all around.
Please allow me, Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Snyder-Hayward. The reason why we put this forward is because we don't want it just dealing with nurses, and that's what happens in a lot of facilities that are trying to implement things like masking and different issues. It's just physicians. So we drafted this, and we defined healthcare worker in a way that means anyone and everyone that comes into contact with a patient or infectious material. Okay. So that's from a CEO doing rounds, clear down to the guy in the cafeteria serving you lunch. It's everybody. Facilities now that run these policies don't include everyone. A lot of them don't even include their contracted physicians. So that was a big piece of our legislation, was to try to grab everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We don't have the fiscal. What I will do is query the committee to see if we have the votes for the amendment. If we don't, we will be moving the bill as is. I don't want to send a fiscal request unnecessarily until I know, you know, if we can pass it with the amendment. So
we're looking at things here. So
okay, all right. So we are going to carry over Senate Bill 1503 to Wednesday. It doesn't mean we'll have everything ready for Wednesday, but time is getting short. So I'll close the work session on 1503, and I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1577, correct, Senator Rosenbaum?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so apparently she's got a dad.
Shall I go ahead?
And Gary Weeks, you're listening. Senator Rosenbaum is, we're now have a public hearing on your bill that you're going to testify on. Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Diane Rosenbaum. I'm the senator from District 21, which is in Southeast Portland, Northeast Portland, and Milwaukee, and soon to be Oak Grove and Clackamas County. I'm very pleased to appear today in support of Senate Bill 1577, as well as to see that one of my chief co-sponsors is on the dais, Senator Bates, so I'm sure you will be hearing good, healthy discussion of this bill. Senate Bill 1577 represents a real opportunity to take existing Oregon programs and use them better to save money, money we desperately need in these challenging budget times, and to make sure that we are taking the tools that we have and doing what Oregonians elected us to do, basically making the most out of every penny that we have. And so, as you know, in 2003, the legislature authorized the formation of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. That was a drug purchasing pool, and it was designed to increase access and reduce costs for prescription drugs for uninsured Oregonians and to lower prescription drug costs for state agencies and for local government. As you also know, participation in OPDP is optional for state agencies, and although it's been an extremely successful program, some of our largest agencies are not currently participating. And you will recall, I'm sure, because it was in this committee during the 2011 session, that there was discussion about expanding the program to include participation by some of the agencies, like the Department of Corrections, that were not choosing to do so. So as a result of that healthy discussion, there was a budget note created in the 2011 session to require a comparative cost analysis to be done for agencies that are not currently using the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to determine if they actually would save money by getting into the program. And so specifically, in terms of the Department of Corrections, that report showed that the agency would save as much as $1.4 million a year based on only half of the Department of Corrections drug purchases being made through the purchasing pool. So I think as anybody would be able to see, $1.4 million a year is real money in these current times when we're stretched very thin and trying to find ways to be more efficient with the resources we have. I think it's clear that this actually holds the potential to both save money and do it in a way that will make sure that we're being able to target resources where they're needed. There obviously are other agencies in addition to the Department of Corrections that could be participating. Hopefully some of those will choose to do so as well. I want to point out that in the bill there is language that says that if an agency or entity can be able to show that they can save money and get drugs at lower prices through other means than by participating in the Oregon Prescription Drug Pool, they're still free to do that. It simply applies this requirement unless they can show that they would save more money elsewhere. So I commend Senate Bill 1577 to you. I think a lot of good work has gone on in the interim on this bill. I'm sure you will hear comments from others about how this can work. I know there are a few amendments. One is a technical amendment. I think that's the dash one. There's an amendment changing the effective date of the bill, which I believe is the dash two. And we certainly have no problem with those amendments. But I hope that you will be able to take this bill up and move it expeditiously to the Ways and Means Committee so that these savings can be realized and that we will be able to do something to be accountable and efficient with our scarce resources. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know there are others in the room and on the phone who will be able to do so as well.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the Oregon Prescription Drug Program purchase at the 340B pricing discount level? That's your rural hospital designations.
I'm sorry, Senator Morris. I'm not sure I fully understand the question, and I'm definitely probably not capable of answering it right now. I think there probably are people in the room who
I'll
could answer
Tom
that, though.
To come up.
We have the administrator of the program here who I believe would be able to answer that better than I can.
But before he starts,
there are the dash threes also, and they were just given to me. So I think it'll behoove us to for you to take a look at those also. We won't be doing anything with the bill, and I don't want to request fiscals until I know which amendments we want to go with. Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority, to Senator Morris's question. To the extent that the writer of the prescription is a 340B qualified provider, we do get 340B drugs. But it flows through the writer of the prescription, not the patient.
It's a narrow universe, though, isn't it?
It is a very narrow universe, yes.
And as a follow-up, that's a federal domain, not a state statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, it is a federal law.
The more I learn about prescription drug pricing, the less it makes sense.
Amen to that.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you finish?
I'm done.
Okay, I didn't. Okay.
Well, not really. But
I didn't mean to interrupt you. That was. So the only question I have about this bill at this point, and thank you for bringing it forward. I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. But I have a question that I want clarity on. This is basically an opt-out. You will use this unless. And how expensive is the unless? I mean, if you're a large, I don't know, maybe you've got the PEB or some other group that you're dealing with, is it expensive for them to prove that they have a better program going than what you're offering through this plan? And I wouldn't want to put a lot of burden on them or expense on them to prove that, in fact, they've got a better deal going than you're offering. I think for the most part, you know, OYA and corrections absolutely should go to this. They were resistant last time for reasons I never understood. But I'm kind of like Senator Morris over here. Sometimes I shake my head. But there could be situations where it might be expensive for someone to prove that. I want to make sure that we're clear that it's not expensive. It's something they can easily comply with, and if they're doing a great job, let them go. And if they're not, they got to use the program.
And just a follow-up on that very same, I remember from testimony last time, April 9th, actually, because I have the letter from Regents. And Regents has its own pharmaceutical program, and it was less costly, and they brought the data to show. So they would have to then prove that their program is less costly, and then they would be given whatever. That's how the bill's set up now.
Senator Morris, I'm sorry.
I think it's a huge compliment, by the way. For him, it's, you know, a real slam, but for me, it's like, okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Bates. Let me start with Senator Bates, if I might, Madam Chair. The cost to do the analysis depends on the size of the agency. The DLC review that we did a first cut at and are currently doing a cut at was absorbed both within OPDP and DLC, the cost of doing the review. The biggest single cost for doing a review would be PEB. PEB is the only major state agency that really resides outside of OPDP at this point. Don't hold me the dates. 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, there was an analysis done by the PEB board, not by Regents. It was the PEB board that would have absorbed the cost for it. And I believe the cost for that analysis was in the range of $50,000. I have looked at that analysis. I have don't know what went into that cost. I can tell you that the analysis, if you just look at the cost of drugs, showed a savings of about $2.2 million. Where the cost that was attributed to that analysis occurred was in the administrative overhead of the programs. And I don't fully understand why that analysis showed what it did, but there was an administrative cost that therefore said if PEB were to move, it would be less expensive. At this point, 3 or 4 years out, the marketplace has changed dramatically in prescription drugs. There are many, many more generics out there. It is really the generics where the savings occurs, because one company buys from generic house A, the other company buys from generic house B, and it depends on the relationship between the two purchasers as to which generic house will give you the best price. And I don't know what the answer would be today, but it would be an opt-out. It's come in unless, and I know that PEB has is in the process of reviewing its current contracts for the overall medical contracts. This is the perfect timing to flow this into their review process, and I think that we can work with PEB to make sure that, it is would occur in their normal review of their contracts that are going out for bid over the next 12 to 18 months.
Oh, yeah, Senator Cruz and then Senator Steiner.
Yeah, Tom, I'm just one of the issues that came up last time was like, for example, with PEB is writing contracts without RX and how that really works. And there's some difficulty in there, I think, as far as getting to you may save money here but cost more over here sort of thing.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you're absolutely right. Right now, when an agency, be it PEB or anybody else, goes out to buy health care, they are say, this is our population pool, this is the kind of benefit we want, this is the, and ask for a price. Included in that price is the cost of hospitals, the cost of doctors, the cost of drugs. What this bill would require is that those costs be broken out individually so that the decision maker can look at the cost of drugs. Now, it may be that when you do a group purchase of all three, that you get overall one price. If you were to break it up, you may see a less cost on the drugs and a more expensive cost on the on the medical side. But I would hope that this bill is written broadly enough to allow it to be the overarching cost to the provider, not just the drug cost. And at least as the person who would be implementing this, that would certainly be the way I would look at it. If it doesn't save money overall to PEB, not just on drugs, then PEB ought not to be in it.
Yeah.
It has saved money for OEB.
Okay, Madam Chair, that was the thing. It's got to be net sum on this, not just taking one piece of it.
So. Yeah. Senator Steiner?
Madam Chair, thank you. There are two ways that, at least two ways in theory, that this bill could save money. If you imagine PEB going in under OPDP, first of all, is the direct savings to PEB in terms of where they buy their drugs from. But in theory, we would expand the purchasing power of OPDP. Do you have a sense of that $2.2 million, for example, included that savings as well, or whether that was just the direct savings for PEB? And if it didn't, do you have a sense of what the... I mean, hard to predict, but, you know, if we have that many more people, then presumably our unit price on various drugs would go down.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner,
we get pretty good prices there too.
You're absolutely right. The analysis that was done before was a PEB only analysis. Clearly, if PEB were to come into the program, the size of the program would double, and that would have an impact on the rest of the program. I can't without so a whole lot of guesses can't answer that question for you.
But you think it would help the cost?
I think it would absolutely
help
the cost.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I just add that, you know, who knows how this will eventually play out, although we clearly now have very hard data about the Department of Corrections, and that's where a lot of the discussion focused during the 2011 session, and I think you'll hear more about that. But other states like Washington have gone through a similar process, have looked at making a change to their own similar bulk purchasing pool and chosen to make that change. And so we can look at experience in other states. But I think the main thing about this bill and the need for it to go forward is that as you're moving into so many changes to try to make healthcare more efficient and affordable, this just fits perfectly within that approach. And I think we now have some hard data for you to look at that you didn't have last session. So hopefully that will help resolve questions and the bill will be able to move forward soon.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Maybe this is a question to you, Tom. Would there be an adverse impact with this bill, with the inclusion of PEB in particular, if you had a physician that was writing scripts from a 340B qualifying hospital, and those rates would be lower than they would be through the prescription drug purchasing program? And if that's the case, there's a huge, I believe there would be a very large premium by forcing PEB in and those participants that are being treated through the 340B program.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morris, the 340B program would work regardless of where it is, which program it's in. PEB would get the savings regardless of whether it is a savings that is currently run by Providence or whether it is a program run by the OPDP program. 340B prices are 340B prices, and both groups would get advantage of those prices. So it may be on a drug-by-drug basis there can be some differences, but we shouldn't look at this on a drug-by-drug basis. You have to look at it over all drugs, and some drugs may go up and some drugs may go down, but overall, and I don't think 340B is going to be impacted by this one way or the other, because we both have 340B programs, Providence and us.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, so just for people outside of these three agencies, an individual walks into Safeway or Fred Meyer's as a member of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, do you also anticipate that that person who happens to have the card will see their prescription drug prices go down as well?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, that's the same question that Senator Steiner asked, and that is, to the extent that the pool expands and we can negotiate better rates, there is a possibility that that would occur. But until we absolutely get down and can do that, I couldn't answer in detail.
Okay. One final comment.
And this really is just a comment that I just like to, I guess, take a moment to remind people of. And Tom, you'll, I hope, appreciate this. This is a program that for individuals, it's really important. I mean, I have a stack of papers in my office just saying call this number, and I can't print them fast enough. That's how much they get used for people who are just have private insurance. This is a boon to those people. And we would be remiss if we didn't remember Senator Morissette and the champion he was for this and how hard he worked for 10 years to get this put together, and what a great thing it's been for patients in our state. These are hard-working, regular middle-class people who have private insurance but needed some extra help with their prescriptions. And, I mean, I literally can't print those things fast with my printer in the office. We put them out, and they're gone in a week, and we put 100 out a week.
Need a new printer.
Well, we got a new one, but she can only work so fast.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because, in fact, I just, before we came into session, I think in December, attended a 10-year anniversary celebration for the creation of this program, which obviously was a result from some hard work that both Senator Morissette and ARP did, and I'm sure some of the people in this room were there at the time, and it was really a wonderful groundswell of how people believing in something, and Senator Morissette in particular, believing that something could be done, was able to overcome a lot of initial skepticism and turn it into something extremely successful.
Amazing.
Well, my staff does refer a lot to this. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would like to have Israel Cavazos and then Gary Weeks give their testimony.
Gary, are you still there?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Whoops. Hello, my name is Izzy Cavazos, and I am a member of SEIU, Local 503, and I also work for the Oregon Youth Authority. Chair Moines Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for taking my testimony today. SEIU, Local 503, or excuse me, I'm just kind of reading my prepared statement here. Senate Bill 1577 ensures that agencies that provide prescription drugs are using Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which is set up to provide lower cost drugs to agencies and local governments. Senate Bill 1577 is meant to be a bill that helps the state save money. Oregon Youth Authority currently has a contract to buy their prescription drugs through contractor Payless, and at the time when proposals to reduce educational services for Oregon Youth Authority, for the youth of the Oregon Youth Authority, that contract should be reviewed to ensure that it provides cheaper options than OPDP instead of continuing businesses as usual. Thank you for your time, and it's one step to ensuring that we provide quality services at the lowest cost possible.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Gary Weeks, it's your floor. You're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Gary Weeks. Prior to retiring a year ago, I served 30 years in state government. and was your director of four different agencies. And I appreciate, Madam Chair, the chance to do this by telephone. I apologize to all the committee members that I can't be there in person today. I don't want to repeat all of the good testimony that you've already heard, so I'll just try to pick out a few things that I think are important to say about this bill. Perhaps the first is to echo Senator Bates. Over the last decade, BDEP has performed exactly as you, the legislature, envisioned it to do so. And in my 30 years in government, I saw a lot of programs created, and I saw a lot of visioning about what those programs would do, and many of them never actually achieved what was hoped for. This is one where I think you all can take credit for putting this program together and having it operate in a way that has indeed provided both access and lower cost for drugs to the uninsured and for drugs that are purchased by state agencies and even some local governments. As you may know, it's a very broad program available to county, city, state agencies, and so on. So it has worked. It has done its job. In looking at how you compare the savings, what happened in the DOC comparison, which I don't know that has been that well explained, is that you actually, each drug has a national drug code. You can take that national drug code, which tells you who the manufacturer was, what the specific drug is, the strength of the drug, the number of tablets in a bottle. All that comes out of the drug code. You can simply compare drug codes for purchases. So in the case of DOC, the OPDP and DOC worked together to compare what DOC had purchased against what OPDP could purchase, and they used the drug code, national drug codes. Now, the numbers that you got for savings in DOC actually only reflect about 48% of the comparison, because there were some drug codes that simply didn't work as they were trying to compare them. So that's still got to be resolved. But the savings were significant, even comparing roughly half of the drug codes and the purchases that were made. And I think you should also keep in mind that as other agencies have come onto this program, significant savings have been achieved. In 2008, when SAFE came on to the OPDP program, in the first year, the savings were 14%. And I think my number is correct, that there's been over $50 million in savings for SAFE by virtue of using OPDP. And while you think about then the implications of it coming on, remember that it's sort of partner OEBB, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, already does purchase through our drug program. And they serve roughly 170,000 educators in the state. So you have one benefit plan that's already a part of OPDP. So when you look at the combined saving here, there's significant potential between EOC, OYA, PEP, to bring real dollars to the table. This is not a sort of fictitious number. You can achieve some very real savings, and savings that you can use pretty immediately. So I guess I'd hope that you would give this some very serious consideration. See the opportunity we have here. Understand that you have a program that has worked just as you imagined it would and has been very successful. And, you know, if we can find agencies or organizations that can purchase drugs cheaper than OPDP, we obviously want to know about it, because we then want OPDP to be in a position to go to manufacturers and say, well, look, if you're going to sell these drugs here for a lower price to this organization, we want the same benefit. So that opportunity to compare pricing is a good thing for OPDP, and certainly we want drugs purchased at the least expensive way, the most expensive manner possible, with the greatest accessibility to individuals and to agencies. So with that, Madam Chair, again, I appreciate the opportunity to say a few things to you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Weeks. Appreciate it. Questions for either? All right. Thank you very much. And I'd like to call Dr. Bob Glukman from Providence Health Plans, John Powell from Regions, who will address the Dash 3s, and Jim Gardner from Pharma. And that's it. No one else has signed up for this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Mona's Anderson. My name is Bob Gluckman. I'm an internist, and I'm the chief medical officer for Providence Health Plan, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide our input regarding the above bill. We oppose the bill as written, although I will mention that on my way in today, I was just handed the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments, and the Dash 3 amendments may address some of our concerns, but since it was just handed to me on the way in, I reserve my my judgment for and my comments about the bill as written. The first thing I would just kind of mention is that there was, we share the concern that the state has about saving money. Our analysis of the top 25 medications on both by prescribing frequency and total cost of drug based on the prices that are published on the OPDP website for a hypothetical patient population of about 100,000 patients would run somewhere between $3 to $5.5 million more on unit cost. So the question of how much savings there would be on unit cost, I think, deserves greater scrutiny. Of greater concern, though, is the impact at a time when we're really talking about the benefits of medical home integration, that this bill would actually be a carve-out and would disrupt the integration and the benefits of care coordination. So currently, when we administer pharmacy claims, we have seamless integration with our case and disease management programs. So our case and disease managers have easy access to pharmacy data, can assess adherence, can understand gaps in care when patients aren't receiving all the medications, and can have easy access in contacting those providers of care, physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs to help guarantee that they're getting the best prescribing and management of their chronic diseases. I'd also mention that we use our pharmacy claims data in important ways for our incentive programs and quality profiling for our providers. So this is a big advantage in promoting the generic utilization. Our generic utilization tends to run about 5% higher than other commercial insurers. And as a result, there's greater savings than just on the unit cost. And I would also kind of mention that we also are able to use pharmacy data to promote appropriate prescribing, which we, and those opportunities would be lost to us. So as a specific example, if I look at quality profiling for our primary care physicians, we can actually give people feedback on the appropriate use of antibiotics for upper respiratory tract infections. Overprescribing in that situation is a significant health hazard. We would lose that opportunity by not having the seamless integration between our claims and our disease management programs. And then lastly, I would also just kind of mention it adds another layer of complexity because patients would have to have another point of access for customer service and the like. So when we currently administer pharmacy benefits, when we manage the medical benefits, we notice that our calls from patients are much higher because they get confused about who they're supposed to call for what. So, and I think when we add it all up, and look at the fact that the unit costs tend to be higher from what we can tell from most prescribed medications, and the fact that the integration of pharmacy data into our chronic disease management, utilization assessment, generic utilization incentives, and quality profiling, that we think the bill would actually be disruptive and result in higher costs for the state, not lower costs.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Dr. Gluckman, thank you. Two quick questions. I understand that Providence insures people who don't actually see Providence doctors, so this won't be entirely true, but you all have a fully integrated electronic health record at this point. You're currently going through the transition to Epic, which is not a pretty thing to do. But could you not extract prescribing data about inappropriate or appropriate prescribing from your electronic health record as opposed to your prescription drug benefit?
So your question relates to Providence Medical Group, and
yeah,
the health plan is separate from Providence Medical Group.
Understood.
So I think that that would only address the minority of the patients that we serve.
Doesn't the insurance company as a right, I mean, as a condition of membership under a specific insurance plan, have the right to get records from hospitals? I mean, I get letters, as an OHSU physician, I get letters from Providence Health Plan already about a prescribing, and that's only because, is that only because you guys are managing the pharmacy benefit as well?
That is because we are managing the pharmacy benefit and we have access to all the claims data. Okay. So this would add a greater degree of complexity because we would be relying on us to access the... We currently have 3,500 primary care physicians and over 10,000 specialists on our panel. So you'd be asking us to be able to have easy access to all those multiple medical records rather than being able to use the integration of our claims data into the clinical management that we perform.
And just in follow-up, if I may, the one other thing, I mean, the analysis that we've seen here suggests that you all, Providence Health Plan and Kaiser, are already getting much lower costs, however you guys are purchasing drugs. And wouldn't the bill as written allow for you all to opt out if you could demonstrate that you're getting lower costs through OPDP?
So one way that we would, if we were able to demonstrate lower costs, but it puts the burden of proof on us, but the thing I would just kind of also mention is that you, in addition to the unit cost of the drugs, there is the savings on the integration into our case and disease management programs, which would be lost. And in fact, it's quite clear from the original bill that you would exempt Kaiser, which I assume is because you recognize the benefits of integration. Now, it is true that the Amendment -3, and again, I just kind of say it with the caveat that it was handed to me in the hallway on the way in, could also potentially exempt us because we do have a fully integrated benefit management system that's operated by employees of the health plan, and it's a pharmacy benefit management system used to assist in the management of chronic disease. So the -3 amendments may exempt us. It would address a lot of our concerns, but you know, I'm a doctor, not a lawyer, and you know, so I just read this on the way in. So you know, I take that with a grain of salt. But I think that you do need to, at a time when in other areas in healthcare, we're talking about the benefits of integration, I would have considerable caution about the carve-out without the proof that there's actually a unit cost benefit. And from what we can tell so far, based on the information that's publicly reported on the OPDP website, that wouldn't occur.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I was just digesting what he was saying before I wanted to ask a question. I want to follow up with Dr. Steiner for a minute. I'm still not convinced that you couldn't opt out of this from what we heard from Mr. Burns, so we'll have further discussion about that. But I'm also going to follow up on using claims data to help guide physicians in writing prescriptions and doing best practices. I do work with organizations that have a very different way of doing that, and I think that it's time to move way, way past the time to move off claims data in order to do this. I commonly get information from Providence, which is frankly now being thrown away. The claims data is late. It's commonly something, a drug that's been discontinued. The way to do it is through an EMR and what's up to date and happening with that patient. And if you're going to cling to claims data in discussing this bill, I would ask you to think past that, because the claims data is so often wrong. Things have changed so much. Various physicians are involved. I know it's going to be a long time before we get to a really good interactive EMR, but I got to tell you, that's not an argument for me for this particular bill. And I'm hoping we're all going to move into the 20th century here and get EMRs that really make sense. When I get a message from Providence saying this patient is using this drug from that doctor, or have you thought about this other drug, doc, for the patient, we'll have up-to-date information based on clinical data, not claims.
I'd like to address that because I've been practicing in nurse for 25 years, and I think that the information is complementary. So I recognize that it can be annoying when you get something and you say, well, I already stopped that drug. One thing that's very difficult for to be able to extract from electronic medical record data is adherence data, because you don't know if the patient has actually filled the prescription or not. So I think that it needs to be fully integrated so that when we see, either through claims and through lack of prescribing, that our case and disease managers can actually interact with the patient and also can notify the doctor, so it can actually augment and be quite complementary rather than one or the other.
We can bore you to death with this conversation. And stop.
Let's go ahead with John Powell.
I have an answer for that, too.
Well, Madam Chair, before John starts, let me say that this is a valuable discussion, because I don't think it's either or, and you don't. You know, we're transitioning, and electronic medical records, I don't think, is in full power yet. And,
not by long shot.
And looking at the state's history of IT, I'm not sure it'll happen in my lifetime. So we need to be very careful about jumping into something that that may fall on its face, Senator Bates.
Well, the state may, but the private won't.
That's true. That's true.
John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I can shorten my testimony dramatically by saying I don't disagree with anything the good doctor here relayed to you. In fact, would have said much of the same thing, a little bit slower, because I don't know it as well. However, I
clarify, since we have three doctors in the room. Dr. Gluckman, correct?
And that's an improvement over adding three lawyers in judgment. Madam Chair, as the doctor pointed out, the Kaiser Amendment does, in fact, speak to the integration model and
When you say Kaiser Amendment, the dash three.
No, in the original bill.
It
was an amendment last session. It's in the original bill this time. And that's why I wrote the dash three amendments to say that if you are integrating the pharmacy benefit with the medical benefit, just as with an enrolled HMO model such as Kaiser, that you would not be subject, or the health plan that does it that way with their own employees and have been doing that so that somebody can't come in and just set up a phony shell, but you've been doing that to deal with chronic disease management, that you would be exempt. Now, that doesn't mean that the contractor or the agency couldn't go with OPD. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means we would not have to go through every time there's a renewal this proof. And secondarily, it would allow the purchaser to weigh the benefits of the other portions of the program and the other savings so that it wouldn't just be drug costs. And the study that PEB did a few years ago, in fact, pointed that out, that this is not a unit cost only issue. It's broader than that, and you're talking about the overall health of the subscriber and how the pharmacy benefit can be used to manage chronic diseases. And as the doctor pointed out, we will intercede if somebody is on insulin and stops getting that prescription filled. They can be contacted. Why is that going on? Are you short on funds? There are programs for that. Are you changing doctors? What is the problem? Or has your doctor decided you don't need insulin anymore? So the amendment, the dash three before you, is an attempt to recognize those fully integrated programs and to really do the same thing that the Kaiser provision does.
Okay, and I think that we won't be moving forward with this bill, but I think it's important for the proponents who brought the original bill to us to take a look at the dash threes, and then we'll be carrying this over on Wednesday and have them come back as to whether they are in favor or against the dash three.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. And as I will say just briefly by way of background, the old-timers here will remember that PhRMA was actually one of the promoters and pushers of the original Senator Morissette legislation way back when, because we recognize that it's entirely reasonable for the state to achieve proper efficiencies in its purchasing by aggregating its demand. And that's an entirely rational approach to managing the state as a business. I want to talk just briefly about one of the amendment that Senator Rosenbaum was referring to as the technical amendments. Very important is the dash one. And again, those of you will recall from last session that the effect of the current law, the unintended effect of the current law, is to exclude PEB and OEB from eligibility to participate in OPDP. The reason for that is that in 2009, when OHA was created, the Oregon Health Authority was created, PEB and OEB were put under the aegis, under the jurisdiction of OHA. And the Medicaid carve-out that is in the current law, which is actually not changed in the printed, in the original introduced version of the bill, refers to the state agency that receives federal Medicaid funds. That's OHA. But it also, it also inadvertently pushes PEB and OEB outside of eligibility. The Dash 1 amendment restricts that as was intended, just to the Medicaid program. So you really need to adopt, and I think Mr. Burns can flesh this in if you like, you really need to adopt the Dash 1s if you want to have OEB and PEB eligible to participate.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much. We will be carrying this over. I don't think we need to have a public hearing, I think, but I will, if you will be in the audience, because we do need feedback from SEIU and Senator Rosenbaum's office on the Dash 3s. Okay. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1577. You've moved it over. And we'll go back, and we are not hearing Senate Bill 1506, the Central Oregon Psychiatric Prescribing Program. Proponents are still looking at what they want to do regarding what they will propose on possible changes. So we'll carry that one over to February 8th.
Wednesday,
yes. Let's go back up to Senate Bill 1504.
Yep.
Would you remind us, Sandy, what that bill is about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1504, you'll recall, are several, multiple technical fixes to Senate Bill 89 that came forward that DCBS proposed, as well as Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I'm sad to say that we have the amendments. The Dash 2s are what the proponents were requesting, but I have not received a fiscal back on the Dash 2s.
So
at this point, we're kind of in a holding pattern.
And
still.
So there's really no further testimony that we need on Senate Bill 1504. So we will carry that over, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1504 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1507. Sandy, can you remind us what this one was about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this one you'll recall is about the HIV consent proposal that has been brought forward to us. After our last meeting on the 3rd, the proponents of the bill requested an amendment. We do have that amendment before us. Just like everything else, got it today. So I don't have a fiscal.
Now, which one?
The Dash 2s.
No, they came not from ACLU, not from the proponents.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. Yes. Well, there's two amendments.
Well, I know the Dash 2s came from ACLU.
So
do we have a
proponents?
One?
Yes, we do, but the ones came in last week, because I do have a fiscal on the ones.
And that we do need. Okay, so I
so
would
the
like.
The ones we do have before us that we brought,
okay.
That we chatted about on the 3rd, and then the 2s I just got today, but I just put the.
The 2s.
So I'd like. I put another request in, but
Becky,
they're here.
Strauss, if you'd come up and explain what these
there
Dash 2s are, would do.
We still want special modification.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss, here representing the ACLU of Oregon. The idea, the intent behind the Dash 2s is meant to ensure that when a provider does choose the option of using a general medical consent form to provide the required notice and opportunity to opt out, the point of the Dash 2s is to make sure that the true notice is preserved in that general medical consent form. So what the What the amendments would do is require that in the event that the provider does use the general medical consent form, that two things would be required of the form, that the notification is presented separately from other provisions in the form, that being notification of HIV testing is separated out from the other language, and that the form include a separate signature line so that the individual has an opportunity to decline if that's something that the patient chooses to do.
Okay. Any comments, questions? Thank you very much. And there's, we don't. Okay.
If the dash twos are to be considered, Madam Chair, I don't have any of the paperwork to go with it.
Well, we're in a work session.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1507.
And Senator Cruz moves the dash ones. And if you recall, that had to do actually with laboratories and making sure that they weren't held accountable to liability issues, which is more technical.
Do you want Christina Bowling to come up
okay.
and refresh us?
Yes.
Okay, we've got Fizz Riz, right?
Yes. On the warrants.
Thank you, Chair Morris Anderson, members of the committee. So we requested Amendment Dash 1 to Senate Bill 1507 because the Oregon State Public Health Lab expressed some concerns that the bill in its current state could imply that the responsibility for notification and consent would fall on the laboratory technician. The original wording in Section 1, Subsection 2, is a person may not perform an HIV test, and so they were interpreting that as the actual person who performed the test as a lab technician. So in discussion with them and with the Oregon Public Health Division, we drafted this amendment with language that Dr. Seaman and I are quite comfortable with.
Any further discussion? Oh, did you say you didn't say your name for the record?
I thought. My name's Christina Bauman.
Okay, is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Are we voting the dash ones right now?
Dash ones.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion amendment adopted. The dash twos dash ones are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1507 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 1507 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the dash twos, we're not going to wait on the intention
no
of the
one
chair.
No one made a motion to adopt the dash twos.
Madam Chair, if I could, we could hold everything up or we could move it. I would suggest we move it as is. It's a good bill. If that needs to be considered, they could do it on the House side.
Okay. I was just a little caught off guard because based on my understanding of where the support for the amendment was. So I appreciate that.
I'm not part of the bill just the way it reads with the dash one, so I just don't know what's happening down the other end of the here. So we need to move
any
this bill.
Further,
we got a very
any
short time
further
here.
Discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Morgan? Aye. Motion carries and
Carrier?
I'll be glad to.
Oh,
well, you know who should actually carry this?
Oh, she's not a member of the committee.
Doesn't mean she can't carry it.
She can still carry it.
Ooh, freshman hazing.
Yes.
Freshman hazing.
We're going We're going to have yes, Senator Steiner carry the bill. Since she's been here for all of the public hearings, this will be her first bill, and we'll give her a real good time on the
yes,
floor.
Yes, we will.
Okay.
You don't know about this, do you?
I most certainly do. I've
okay.
been worried.
With that, I will close the work okay. session. Did I say everything that I needed to on that? On 1507.
Good
and
idea,
open a work session on Senate Bill 1565. Sandy, remind us where we are with this one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1565 permits supervising physician or supervising physician organizations to apply to the Oregon Medical Board for dispensing authority for physician assistance. For dispensing, this is the Zoom Care Bill. We've heard from Len Bergstein a couple of times. We have a dash one amendment and a dash two. I do have a fiscal on both of them, and there's no revenue on both of them. So,
okay, so we did have, I'd like Elizabeth Remley to come up to testify. She wants to put on record the intent and hope for the language about dispensing training for PAs. And if you just explain that and get it on the record, because we did talk to legislative counsel, and as long as we get it on the record, we won't have to get an amendment.
I hope so. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Physician assistants are currently privileged by the medical board to dispense drugs in instances of underserved populations. And what we're hoping is that with dash two amendments, that those privileges are completely separate from the privileges granted under this bill in Zoom care and other clinical type settings. We do not want any of the privileges that are currently granted by the medical board for those underserved populations to be included in this bill, either in the dispensing privileges part or the training, because we want to keep it the same way that it is right now for those privileges, which are pretty limited privileges in that in an underserved population where maybe the PA is the only provider available in an area and the pharmacy is only open from 9 to 5 on Monday through Friday, a PA can give out maybe a 24-hour dose of something to get the patient through to the time where they can go to the pharmacy to fill their prescription. And we just want to keep those privileges separate from what Zoom Care is trying to do, which we support. So I hope that makes sense. If you have any questions, ask them.
Yes,
now.
And we do want to have it on the record that the intent is
yes.
for that. And I just wanted to make sure that the proponent of the bill is in concurrence with that.
Senator Morris Anderson, the committee, yes, I concur.
Okay. All right. Great.
Len Bergstein, for the record.
And Bergstein, yeah. Okay.
And yeah, we had legislative counsel look at it, and they don't think we need a separate amendment to make sure that the training doesn't apply to those privileges. So.
Excellent.
Okay.
Ones and twos.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, just a moment. We have PAs working in very rural areas sometimes, and they're kind of isolated. Their supervising physician is way out there. This bill, does anybody restrict what they can do if we have to give out a Vicodin or a narcotic or anything else? Is this bill going to restrict them in any way that they're not restricted now?
Legislative counsel has given us opinion that no, it will not.
Senator Morris Anderson and Senator Bates, that's the reason for the dash two, is to preserve basically all the language that's on your page 8 of your bill so that it demonstrates exactly what privileges exist now would stay with those PAs.
And follow-up question, Mr. Burns. Have you reached an agreement with the pharmacist yet on this bill?
Yeah, Senator Morris Anderson and Senator Bates, yes. Everybody is in concurrence that this is a good bill, should move through. This is a no-drama bill.
It is. We removed the...
Yes, that's true. No, I'm really...
By removing the nurse practitioner section
and by hiring pharmacists into the system. And it's actually a groundbreaking development in terms of working pharmacists into the clinical team. So, yes.
All right.
Okay,
we are in work session.
I'm trying to move the dash one amendment, Senator Bill 1565.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1565. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Motion adopted.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment into Senate Bill 1565.
Senator Cruz moves the dash twos into Senate Bill 1565. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1565 as amended by the dash one and dash two amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 1565 as amended with the dash ones and dash twos. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've put a lot of thought into this bill. I've voted against it in the past because I was concerned about ZoomCare's lack of 24/7 on call and what would happen if something, if a mistake was made, then we'd just, the person would be shunted to the emergency room and the mess to be cleaned up there. I've been persuaded that that ZoomCare in the coming months will be going to 24/7 to provide on-call services in the coming months. And I also had some concerns that with ZoomCare not taking Medicaid and Medicare patients, and I've been persuaded that in the coming months they will be providing a plan once per week to see their share of Medicaid patients. And so those two things, changing my comfort level, has allowed me to feel more comfortable moving the bill forward, and I will be an aye vote.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Bates.
Ditto, Senator Shields.
All right. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In an abundance of caution, I'd also like to indicate that I have a potential conflict of interest in that my wife is a primary care provider in some of the same areas that ZoomCare is located.
Okay. All right, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman
Bennett? Aye. Motion passed. This is Senator Courtney's bill, so we will ask Senator Courtney if he would like to carry it. If not, Cruz will be a backup. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1565 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1522. And we'd like to bring Craig Hotstetler and Kevin McChesney.
1522.
And Madam Chair, I have a dash one amendment.
And a dash one.
It just kind of showed up on my desk.
Magical.
You have
anything other than appearing like magic?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Hostetler from the Oregon Primary Care Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. We recognize that we need to move forward with this transformation, and so the intent of this bill is not to slow that down. However, since the CCO implementation plan does not mandate an accounting for the factors of adjustments for payment and metrics for psychological and social characteristics of the patients served, we think it's critically important that this bill goes through so that the CCOs can hold the CCOs can be held accountable for setting up systems to really adjust metrics and payment. I've been up here before you, so I won't go through all the testimony that I did before. I will keep it short. Our intent of moving this bill forward is to emphasize how difficult it is to improve the health of patients. It's not impossible, but it does take more time and resources to move metrics on some of these patients that have severe barriers to both psychological and social. Without this bill, we won't account for the psychological and social complexities. And there was a JAMA article in August of 2010 that highlighted if payment goes forward in pay-for-performance type of systems without these adjustments, that it could have the unintended consequence of increasing health disparities. That's why this bill is so important, that even though we don't have perfect metrics now, that we at least have a placeholder to get them into the future. So we ask you to vote yes on Senate Bill 1522. There are some amendments that just came out today. One that I'd like to highlight for you is the first part of Amendment 1. And what we were doing is just broadening from having representatives of community providers sit on an advisory committee to having healthcare providers and others who work with and advocate for individuals confronted by psychological and social barriers to health, and must include individuals who've experienced these barriers. So it's getting that patient-centered component front and center here as well as broadening the net of people that would be advising on this important issue. And that's all. I'll keep it brief, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I represent the Oregon Residential Providers Association, whose members provide residential care for individuals with mental illness and or substance abuse disorders. ORPA membership reviewed this draft of this bill and voted to support it. We also felt that the CCO implementation plan was really short on detail for this population, those individuals who have sociological and psychological challenges. I have the pleasure to work for a company that operates the Crisis Assessment and Treatment Center in Multnomah County, and I can tell you that far more than 50% of our admissions at that program are individuals who present at an emergency room with a psychiatric crisis that's very often brought on by either psychological or sociological conditions, and it's the easiest door to get into the system. Many of them also have a substance abuse disorder or chronic medical condition as well. We really feel it's critical that outreach and coordination of care for this population is crucial to controlling healthcare costs under the healthcare transformation. So we really feel it's important that the CCO organization, the metrics, and the outcome measures reflect the special needs of these particular populations. Thank you.
Discussion? Yes, sure. Senator Bates.
I don't disagree with anything you're saying in this bill, but I can make the same argument for dental. I know of cases where people have not received dental care, end up in the hospital with sepsis, have to have heart valve replacements, go on dialysis for kidney failure, all from infections starting with bad teeth. I can make an argument for people with physical problems that didn't get good access and weren't taken care of preventively. This group is a little more at risk for that, I admit that, and has been underserved a lot of times in the past. But the goal of the CCOs is to take care of these people. And once we start calling out certain sections of it, I think we're going to run into something that will never end. The diabetics will want to be called out. The asthmatics will want to be called out. It goes on and on and on. And while I agree with all what you're saying here, I'm just not sure I see the necessity of it. The CCOs are going to do what we expect them to do. This is the reason we're putting the CCOs together. This is the reason we're doing CCOs right here. And I don't think we need to call it out more than we're doing already in the bill. But I understand what you're saying, and I hear you. Don't get me wrong. But I could start rewriting the entire bill with different groups coming in here very quickly and easily. And I'm not sure I want to do that right now. We're just forming these things up. There's lots of issues out there with them, very difficult issues. And this just throws one more thing into the fire, and I just don't think it's time to do that right now.
Further discussion? All right.
Just as an aside, I think this discussion points out the need for the medical liability reform.
Ooh, let's work up something.
think there's right relating clause here.
Chairman Sandin, may I reply to that statement?
Yes.
Okay, because I hear what you're saying, Senator Bates, and we don't want to pack bills too full of items, but I think in this situation, we have a lot of ability to adjust for medical complexities. That's what our system is really good at. What we're not good at is when we have a diabetic that's homeless and, you know, a substance abuser and has some other issues. We don't have any way to adjust that's comprehensive and put into a payment system. So what this is saying is we need to adjust for that, because what happens is if you're getting paid for taking care of diabetic patients and you've got one with psychological or social barriers to health, providers will avoid that as we go to value-based pay, because it takes more time, it takes more resources, you get dinged on payment in a pay-for-performance world. And you know, as you know, it's not just about medical issues. In fact, what we do in our healthcare system only accounts for 10% of the determinants of health. 40% is on behavior. And so if we don't have a way for adjusting for that, which we're not good at as a system across the country, that's what I'm saying is here we've got to make sure that the CCOs do have a way to build a way to adjust for that, or else we will promote health disparities by not doing it.
Any further discussion? Okay, thank you very much, and let's carry this bill over to next Monday. A little bit more.
For just the work session, Madam Chair?
Yeah, just for work session. All right, I do have a question. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1522, and it looks like we're done with the agenda. I do have a question. I had heard that the House had passed House Bill 1453, which were a number of the issues that were presented to us as needing to get into Senate Bill 1580. So I had a question for Senator Bates on what he is doing with his bill 1509.
I'd like to just leave it in the hands of this committee for the time being.
Okay.
All right. See what we do.
We have scheduled it for Wednesday, and we haven't seen any amendments coming forward, so we were just curious.
Yeah, I think we'd like to, at this point, we're to focus on the bill we have and the ways and means we'll be hearing on tomorrow night. We'll have the first set of amendments out, which you'll see as amendments. We have something black and white to look at. It's for discussion purposes. There'll be more changes coming through. We have to get physicals and all these changes. The bill we have sitting in this committee yet, I'd like just to hold here for the time being.
Okay, that sounds good. I just needed the direction.
And
I wanted it to be
separate. Chances are, Madam Chair, if need be, we could get special dispensation from the President if we need it.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we carried, just as a review, we carried over 1503, we carried over 1504, we moved 1507 and 1565. We moved 1506. I'm not sure they're going to be ready Wednesday. We may have to move that again. 1522 to a week from today, and then we're carrying over 1577. Okay. Thank you, committee.
Work session only?
Work session, yeah. We're adjourned.